دو چشمان مست سیاحت مبند، نازنی نازداری با موی کمند، از اول جلوه ها می کنی صد هزار، پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی و چند.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Oh, thank you for having me, as always.
And this recent statement from Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan suggesting that the U.S. military and NATO are working hand in glove with the Taliban has forced the U.S. military to increase security to protect their own troops, who are, by the way, subject to these internal attacks from people that they're training in particular. Is that what essentially is happening there, that Karzai is basically signaling to the Afghan people that the Americans are the enemy?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, obviously one of the most outrageous provocations that we've heard from President Karzai in a good long while. But it's not the first. I mean, if you go back and you look at his statements going really back to the beginning of the Obama administration, Karzai has made a number of very dubious assertions and has been increasingly trying to make it appear as if he is distancing himself from the Americans. And there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, we are going to be withdrawing not soon enough, in my opinion. And what's going to keep him alive or dead is going to be his standing amongst Afghans. And so I think what he is understanding is that it's politically expedient for him to distance himself from the United States and NATO. You might recall a few years back, he made a number of comments about Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, being Afghanistan's closest ally. So he's got a history of saying things that are quite bizarre. In fact, there's been a growing body of literature about his mental health issues, about his need for medication, and about his instability.
Well, Christine Fair, I remember speaking a long time ago to Peter Galbraith, who was the United Nations deputy head in Afghanistan, and he was trying to force the UN to force a new election because the election of Karzai, the re-election of Karzai, was so fundamentally and so flagrantly crooked. The head of the UN basically cut the legs out from under him and sacrificed him, and they didn't clean up the electoral process. And at the time, Peter Galbraith said that Karzai's nuts. He's a manic depressive. He's bipolar.
That's pretty much the word on the street. I don't know anyone that hasn't interacted with him that hasn't come to that conclusion. There was a pretty explosive article written about him. I was actually an election observer for that election in 2009. And at the time, there was an article, I believe it was in the New York Times magazine, or maybe it was in The New Yorker, but it was a very detailed exposition about his mental state and how deeply fraught it was, and about his propensity to engage in emotional outbursts. But, you know, be that as that may, I mean, I'm not going to detract from what appears to be a consensus that he has significant mental health issues. He is not irrational in trying to distance himself from the Americans. In some sense, there's no cost for him to distance himself from the Americans because we're leaving anyway. And what the Americans would like as a condition for our staying are things that he's not terribly enthusiastic about. And so, you know, anything that he can do to sort of micturate in the bathwaters is quite frankly to his advantage. So he might have mental health issues, but what he's actually doing is very much strategically and politically calculated to try to appeal to whatever base he has remaining.
But if it's as bad as people tell me who've been there, and there was a devastating BBC Panorama documentary recently on the fact that there's no functioning government there and that the military are a bunch of stoned-out conscripts, and the police are incredibly corrupt, and the whole thing is just going to probably collapse as soon as the U.S. gets out. That seems to be a fairly common belief. So if that's true, then who's going to protect Karzai, or is it just going to be like South Vietnam, and all these crooks go and join their money that's already deposited abroad?
Well, that's my sense. I mean, you know, for years, you know, we've talked about Afghanistan on this show for years. I have been an opponent of this surge. I argued years ago that the strategy that we've pursued is a losing strategy because we cannot win counterinsurgency with the resources that we have at our disposal and with the so-called partnership that we've had on the Afghan side. So from the beginning, this has been a losing proposition. What I think is happening is that Karzai is doing exactly what you said. Unlike Najibullah, who was the poor chap that inherited post-Soviet withdrawal of Afghanistan, even though there were no Soviet troops in Afghanistan, he was able to hang on because the Soviets did keep giving money until circa 1992. And he was able to do that because he actually was able to more or less manage a more or less functional patronage system in which he gets money and he pays it downward to those constituencies that are necessary to keep his head on his shoulders. What Karzai has done, rather than building a patronage network, which is what Najibullah had, he's actually built what Sarah Chase has, I think, brilliantly described as a vertically integrated extraction network. Whereas patronage redistributes resources downward to the communities that you're dependent upon, what Karzai has basically done has built a giant machine that sucks up the money from increasingly lower levels and basically has deposited them along with his cronies in places like Dubai, Europe, and elsewhere. I think that if there had been some sort of international convention, I don't even know if such things are legal, to require Karzai to stay in that country and live out his life in Afghanistan. In other words, he's made a bed, he's going to have to sleep in it. Maybe we would have seen a different Karzai. But I think what he's definitely doing is he's feathered his beds in other countries. And as soon as the going gets rough, he's going to split. Remember, in 2014, he won't be the president in any event, unless something strange happens to the Afghan constitution. I don't really see him mucking around with the Afghan constitution to allow him to be a president for yet another term. So we don't even know who's going to be at the helm of Afghanistan when and if we finally, take the last soldier out of Afghanistan.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fares, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So what do you think is going to be left behind in terms of the U.S.? There's been an argument over that. In fact, the top general in Afghanistan, he asked for double the number of troops left behind that the administration had first indicated. But
let me just say about these generals, I am so dismayed by these generals and also their beltway bandits and their other allies in think tanks and in policy communities that have been behind this. You know, it's been said now a couple of times, I think it bears being repeated, if a private loses his weapon, he loses his career. Generals consistently pursue bad policy. They have lost this war. Needless Americans have died since the surge. You know, circa 1,000-ish, about 10,000 Afghans have died. And there's absolutely no accountability. And these generals are absolutely shameless. They keep asking for one more fighting season. They keep asking for more troops. The fact of the matter is, deferring diplomacy to resolve a war that cannot be resolved through fighting is reckless and dangerous, and these generals should be called to Congress to account. I'm sick and tired of these generals running policy, and I really wish that President Obama would get some scrotal fortitude and actually put some leadership behind this campaign.
But isn't Obama concerned of, remember in the Vietnam War, Henry Kissinger's famous phrase, a decent interval? In other words, you don't want the feces to hit the fan until, you know, you're well out of the place and people have forgotten it.
Well, so, the problem is, of course, I mean, the feces has been hitting the fan. In fact, there has never been a time since 2004 that the feces has not been regularly coming into contact with the rotary oscillator. So this is just a fiction. I think we could very easily construct a narrative that this thing was lost when we decided to change the goalpost in 2004. In 2004, we had met our objectives. We had ousted the Taliban. We had defeated al-Qaeda, and we had removed them from Afghanistan. At that point, we should have perhaps jettisoned into a development mission. But this idea that making sure that we have in place secure Afghan national security forces, a functioning Afghan government, you know, this is utter nonsense. This was nonsense of the highest order. And, you know, quite frankly, it's imperial hubris that anyone thought that the Americans could do this. You know, I often, you know, I'm a scholar of South Asia. That's what I do. I look at the institutions that were built up in India as a consequence of British colonialization. And, you know, the Brits were in the Indian subcontinent in one way or another for more than 200 years. So this idea that you could build these sorts of institutions in a matter of a decade, it's risible. So I think it's time for the Americans to sort of demand that we bring our troops home. I don't believe there's anything in Afghanistan that is worth spending any more of our treasure and spending any more of our lives. And quite frankly, the longer we stay, the more Afghans die too. So I think forget this idea of a reasonable interval before the defecation hits the rotary oscillator. The rotary oscillator has already been completely covered in the defecation.
So,
to use your analogy.
I think we should. I don't know.
Scatological discussion.
I agree. We should put this to rest. So, it sort of reminds me, Chris Fair, of the Rudyard Kipling poem about looking at the grave of a British officer, a soldier in Afghanistan. The last line of which is, "Here lies a fool who tried to hustle the East." So it's not a new story, as we know that Afghanistan's being referred to as a graveyard of empires. But
which I think is also sort of silly. I mean, it's not a graveyard of empires. The fact is, Afghanistan has been conquered about 12 to 13 times over history. It's just that is conquering a country really what we're supposed to be doing? You know, there's a little bit of a joke in these counterinsurgency campaigns. When counterinsurgency campaigns have worked, it has largely involved genocide, right? So, seriously, Malaya, genocide. When the Indians defeated the Sikhs in the Punjab, genocide. Sri Lankans putting down the Tamil Tigers, genocide. So, you know, this idea that you can win a counterinsurgency campaign without doing things that are absolutely prohibited by international humanitarian law is a joke. And I really do think it's time that the Americans hold the military and political leadership, and quite frankly, the Beltway bandits that have profited from this war in incredible significant measure. It's time that we hold all these people to account and find a way to get home.
Well, what happened in 2004, obviously that was at the time of the re-election of George W. Bush. And we know in Obama's case that he made a campaign issue out of Afghanistan saying, we dropped the ball in Afghanistan and lost focus and went into Iraq and I'll do it better. So he dug himself into the hole. But what happened in 2004?
Well, see, basically, 2004, we can sort of look back ex post facto and see things that had been changing. By 2004, and certainly by 2005, the Pakistanis had really come to a different conclusion about what was in their best interest. The Pakistanis saw the writing on the wall that even though the U.S. was working with Pakistan to wage the war on terror, and in fairness to Pakistan, there were many al-Qaeda captures that would not have been possible had it not been for Pakistan's cooperation. Be that as it may, the United States under Bush, with the policies advocated by Ashley Tellis and Robert Blackwell, were really one of wooing of the Indians, and obviously culminated in the Indo-U.S. civilian nuclear deal, which is impossible to overstate how much that affected the Pakistanis. And, you know, if you were President Musharraf, you had to have been whipsawed. Here you are. At that point, you're already in the beginning of an insurgency. You've already lost several hundred troops. And here the Americans are giving your nemesis a bomb-friendly nuclear deal. So Pakistani calculus began to change very quickly. In addition, we know that at around 2005, that's when the Taliban began their regrouped offensive to launch the insurgency. Up until 2005, there had really, at the end of 2005, the insurgency had begun. So in 2004, in some sense, that was the sweet period. We'd ousted the Taliban. We weren't there trying to engage in grandiose nation-building or state-building exercises. And that was really the time that we should have pulled our troops out and simply began, you know, what we do elsewhere, which is just running sort of a development program, you know, training some troops, continuing USAID, you know, the maternal and child health programs that we do. But the problem was is that we continue to change the objectives. And it went from rousting al-Qaeda from Afghanistan to basically defeating the Taliban. And I think there are two things that really began to go wrong as time evolved. One, you had all of these generals that had really become political generals, and they had a lot vested in this notion of counterinsurgency and what had happened with the so-called surge in Iraq. And, of course, I think history will show that the so-called surge had nothing to do with the turnaround that happened in Iraq. But nonetheless, those same generals, like in their coterie of not quite generals, they wanted to show that this could also work in Afghanistan. And I think that when Afghanistan became a testing field for new concepts of war fighting, that's when things really began to change to the Taliban's favor. Because, of course, the Taliban were not like al-Qaeda in Iraq, which were foreign. The Taliban are local. And the idea that you could kill the Taliban and thereby dispense with the problem was folly from the beginning. So, I say 2004 was a sort of a sweet spot to reoptimize, but we can say that with, you know, in some sense, the luxury of looking backward.
Well, just in closing, Christine Fair, just turning to Pakistan, a country that you're deeply familiar with, Pakistan's prime minister just hailed as a victory for democracy the completion of a full term by an elected government for the first time in the country's history.
Well, it actually wasn't the first time. People are wrong when they say that. The first time it happened was actually the previous government before this one. So this is actually even more important. It's the second constitutional transition. No one wants to count the first one because it was voted in under Musharraf's tenure. But that term, that parliament did serve out its complete term, and there was a peaceful constitutional transition. So this is even more important than people want to say.
Even though the leader is widely considered a feckless, corrupt, and et cetera, et cetera. I'm talking about
Zardari.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Yeah, look, people say that about him, but quite frankly, that's politics in Pakistan. What people haven't noticed, and I'm not going to exculpate Zardari for all of the corruption that his government has engaged in, because other governments have done the same, including the military regimes, for Christ's sake. But what people have not noticed is that his government, more than others, did his government passed the most legislation. I remember meeting a legislator in 2008 who said to me, "You know, darling, I just don't want to legislate." And my question to her was, "Then why are you a legislator? You chose to be elected. You could have done something else for your living." But so this is a very different, you know, in some sense, politics is quite different now. In addition to that, even though the National Assembly, the parliament, hasn't been on a collision course with the military, they've been involved with national security affairs, something that Pakistanis haven't seen civilians do in a very long time. And this sitting president, despite all of his problems, is the first sitting president to devolve massive powers from the center to the provinces. And he's the first sitting president to devolve presidential powers back to the prime minister. So a lot of people want to focus on his cronyism, on his patronage, and all of those things might be well and true, but to not look at the actual gains of this government, and quite frankly, the political acumen of Zardari in negotiating a veritable minefield over these last 5 years to make sure that his government hangs on, that is a feat that really is worth applauding.
And, you know, this is a man whose wife was shot.
Blown up in a suicide attack and then shot.
Yeah, exactly. And we don't have time to get into who did it. But I thank you so much. I thank you so much for joining us, Christine Fair.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, the former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who's a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about whether or not the North will attack South Korea.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if